political analyst from Brussels. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of The Spotlight. It's all the time that we have for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ يَوْمَ تَجِدُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ مُحْضَرًا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran says reports that it has supplied missiles to Russia are completely wrong and that the small number of drones supplied to Moscow were sent before the war in Ukraine. New polls show a growing number of Americans are worried about the breakout of political violence in the U.S. just as the countdown begins to midterm elections. And Peru's police clash with protesters demanding the resignation of President Castillo, who is facing criminal investigations for corruption.
Hello and welcome to World News, coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Kiev has accused Moscow of using Iranian-made drones in the war in Ukraine. Iran, however, has rejected the allegation, blaming the West for preventing Ukraine from discussing the issue with Tehran.
We agreed with the foreign minister of Ukraine for them to provide us with any evidence that Russia has been using Iranian drones in Ukraine. We had an agreement with Ukraine 2 weeks ago to be held in a European nation. Our political delegation was sent to the country, but unfortunately in the final moments, the Ukrainian side did not show up. The reason was the United States and some European nations, especially Germany, had told Ukraine you want to drink coffee with the Iranians in a European nation while we're trying to impose sanctions due to drones.
Amir Abdullahian made the comments and addressed the reporters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. He rejected claims that Tehran has provided Moscow with missiles in the Ukrainian conflict. Amir Abdullahian, however, said Tehran has provided Russia with a small number of drones, but months prior to the war in Ukraine. The top diplomat noted that the Islamic Republic will not remain indifferent on the matter if it's proven to Tehran that Russia has used Iranian drones in the Ukraine war. Amir Abdullahian comments drew reaction from Ukraine, with President Volodymyr Zelensky accusing Tehran of lying.
Have released a statement today. They have decided to admit that they did supply drones for Russian terror, but they were lying in this recognition as well. We are shooting down at least 10 Iranian drones daily, while the Iranian regime claims that it allegedly provided few of them before the start of the full-scale invasion. Only during one day yesterday, 11 Shaheds were destroyed.
Zelensky accused Iran of teaching the Russian military personnel how to use those drones, adding that Moscow pays Tehran for such cooperation. Ukraine in recent weeks has reported a surge in drone attacks on civilian infrastructure, notably targeting power stations and dams using Iranian-made drones. This is while Russia denies its forces have used Iranian drones to attack Ukraine. Iran has successfully tested the first stage of a homegrown satellite carrier running on solid fuel. The test was carried out by Iran's Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Division. Qaem-100 suborbital three-stage solid fuel space launcher is the first of its kind manufactured by IRGC scientists. The vehicle can carry satellites weighing 80 kilos into an orbit 500 kilometers above the Earth. IRGC authorities say the carrier will be employed for the launch of a satellite called Nahid. The satellite is manufactured by the Iranian Ministry of Information and Communications Technology. Israeli soldiers have killed another Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent, Mona Candil in Ramallah, who gave us more details regarding the latest Israeli crimes.
Well, this night, an 18-year-old Palestinian was transferred to a Palestinian hospital after he was shot by Israeli forces when he arrived at the hospital. 18-year-old Mus'ab Nafel succumbed to his injuries. What happened this night is that Israeli military claimed that Palestinians were throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles on Route 16 near the Palestinian town of Sinjar near Ramallah. The Israeli forces opened fire at whom they describe as stone throwers. They killed this 18-year-old Palestinian and seriously wounded the other young man, and they took him with him. So they opened fire at a Palestinian. He was transferred to hospital and succumbed to injuries. The second one was seriously wounded but was arrested by the Israeli forces. We have to mention that in many cases, Palestinians were killed in cold blood, and then the Israeli forces have said that those people who were killed had either attacked the Israelis, opened fire at them, tried to stab Israeli soldiers, and now they are saying that those Palestinians were throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles in the area of Sinjar.
A new survey has revealed the depth of America's fear surrounding their upcoming vote. 88% of the country is afraid that political violence will occur. There continues to be a lack of clarity regarding the recent attack on the husband of congressional leader Nancy Pelosi, and many wonder if the controversy may fuel even more violence. Rami Mazuri has more on this story from Chicago.
Shortly before their midterm legislative elections, a stunning new poll shows that 9 out of 10 Americans are afraid of politically motivated violence. The blame is apportioned in almost equal thirds. Democrats blame Republicans, Republican respondents hold Democrats responsible, and another third says both parties are equally responsible.
Neither party is actually putting forward any platform for actual unity across race, gender, class, etc., religion, and you know, it's a necessary outcome of just the decades of politicization, and really the political moment that we're in right now, where you know, there's a fascist movement in this country.
There have been 10 times the number of threats against members of Congress than there were just 5 years ago. The arrival of the corrosive Donald Trump and the seemingly equally corrosive repression of his supporters has revealed a national political culture plagued by self-righteousness, anger, and violence. An extensive recent survey found that nearly a third of Americans believe that political violence is usually or always justified.
So I think the violence already is happening. I think it's a question of, you know, as we get closer to 2024, that violence is going to get turned up a dial. So I think it's really it's sad, unfortunate, it's terrible, but I think it's a consequence of, you know, what the ruling class has actually, you know, fomented.
The poll was taken shortly after the in-home attack on the husband of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Many are shocked that the nation's vast and armed-to-the-teeth security services couldn't adequately protect the home of the nation's number three post. The incident continues to be the subject of salacious allegations, which have been exacerbated by the Pelosi's refusal to release their home security footage, as well as the refusal of local police to release their own body camera footage. The suppression of news reports on the incident has further inflamed public opinion. Polls repeatedly show that Nancy Pelosi has the lowest approval ratings of any prominent member of Congress. The Pelosis have been recently accused of insider trading, and the extremely wealthy family is often criticized for flaunting their affluence. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Powerful tornadoes have hit several states in southern U.S., leaving at least one person dead and multiple others missing. The tornadoes caused heavy damage in the states of Oklahoma, Texas, and Arkansas. In some areas, they ripped off roofs, damaged houses, uprooted trees, and knocked down power lines. Tornadoes are a frequent and often devastating weather phenomenon in the United States, with Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas the hardest hit. In December last year, dozens of devastating tornadoes ripped through five states overnight, leaving nearly 80 people dead in Kentucky alone. Scenes of violent scuffles in Peru's capital, Lima, where police have blocked anti-government protesters trying to march on the presidential palace and the parliament. Mounted police used tear gas and charged at a crowd to disperse them. The demonstrators were demanding the resignation of President Pedro Castillo. Similar rallies have been held in other cities across Peru. Lima has also witnessed rival protests by Castillo's supporters. The president, who took office in July 2021, is facing six criminal investigations for corruption. But it's not possible to prosecute him on criminal charges while he is in office. He has already survived two impeachment attempts. Castillo has been defying calls to step down and rejects all accusations of corruption. The UK is bracing for a fresh wave of strikes as nurses vote for their first national action over a pay dispute. More than 300,000 members of the Royal College of Nursing have taken part in the strike ballot, the biggest in the union's 106-year history. Reports show an experienced nurse's salary has fallen by 20% in real terms since 2010. The RCN says the government is exploiting the goodwill and expertise of nursing staff. The industrial action is set to take place within a few weeks. It's likely to disrupt operations and appointments, even as patients are already facing record waiting lists. However, organizers say the action has the support of patients. The UK is struggling with a cost of living crisis. It has seen a wave of walkouts across various industries in recent months. Staying with the UK, public discontent with the government is lingering. Thousands from across the country descended upon the capital, London, on the weekend to protest against the country's worsening cost of living crisis and to demand a general election. Saipur Raza has been to the protest and sent us this report.
Unaffordable rents, choosing between meals and heating, and tears when the bills arrive. Some of the issues that have drawn thousands from across England to the capital on this rainy day.
Concerned about the future, they're protesting against what they see as years of government inaction. It's led to a deepening cost of living crisis, a squeeze on people's finances, and pushed public services to the brink.
Organized by the People's Assembly, they've named the demo Britain is Broken, a name that captures the country's multiple crises.
We're going backwards. You know, we've got hungry children. We've got old people living in like freezing cold flats and it's terrible.
I think the reason for the massive inflation is all the money that they printed throughout COVID. 600 billion was printed through COVID, most of which ended up in the hands of rich people.
The government blames the emergency at home on the crises abroad, such as the war in Ukraine and global energy price hikes. The protesters here say it's all the result of more than a decade of conservative rule and that the time for change has come. The mass demonstration comes only days after the Bank of England increased interest rates yet again to control double-digit inflation. The new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is announcing his economic plan later this month, expected to include increased taxes and cuts to public spending, meaning the outlook for ordinary Britons looks gloomier than it is now. Saeed Pereza, London.
The United States keeps sending more military aid to Ukraine. Washington and its allies maintain that the weaponry is necessary to help Kiev defend itself against Russia. This, as many have warned that such deliveries would only prolong the war. We discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
And I welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. And now the U.S. is stepping up military aid to Ukraine by another $400 million, despite warnings from Russia. U.S. will pay for the overhaul of T-72 tanks and for missiles used in Hawk air defense systems. There's also funding to buy hundreds of tactical unmanned aerial systems and dozens of armored boats. U.S. has been the biggest sponsor of the Ukrainian military since the beginning of the war with Russia in late February. Value of U.S. military aid now stands at close to $19 billion. Moscow has repeatedly warned against the delivery of foreign military aid to Ukraine, saying that it only prolongs the conflict. And now joining us for the program is Professor Paul Sheldon Foote, academic and commentator, joining us from Irvine, California, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Professor Foote, we're going to start with you. Tons of money poured into the Afghan conflict and the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan after the withdrawal. U.S. was really left with nothing, no gains or wins from that conflict. And basically, U.S. taxpayers were hearing the chorus get louder and louder. They're starting to oppose this much funding when there's so much to be spent on for infrastructure back home. Your thoughts on where U.S. taxpayers are right now on this Ukraine support?
We have the latest opinion poll from Reuters, October 4th and 5th, and it's a typical opinion poll of American voters. You have typically on a given question, how many of you heard of this issue? 15% say they've never even heard of the Ukraine issue. Another approximately 20-25% said very little. And yet when you ask them what's their opinion on what we should be doing, they say, many of them say, well, send in American troops or send more weapons and so forth. So you have the typical ignorant American voter who doesn't even know where Ukraine is on the map and even admits that they've never even heard of it. And that's hard to do with the mainstream media constantly pumping out Zionist and neoconservative propaganda. For not to even hear of it, it shows you how out of it American voters are. But we have an election next Tuesday, so this makes for great political hay between the two parties, because you have many Republicans saying, if we're elected, we're gonna cut off all spending to Ukraine. And you got Democrats saying the opposite. So they're both looking at the same opinion polls. They know how soft it is in these deals, that it's just the way you word the questions in opinion polls, the answers you're gonna get from the voters. And basically, the voters are quite ignorant, but they have strong opinions anyway.
Thank you, Professor. And Robert Fantina, welcome to the program there, Robert. Your initial thoughts on this.
It's interesting that the U.S. voters, as your other commentator mentioned, aren't very familiar with Ukraine, but want to send troops there. There's always, in the United States, the idea that might makes right, that bombs and soldiers and the terrorism that those bring will bring some positive results. It makes no sense. It makes no reasonable and logical sense. It's interesting that just a few weeks ago, the Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party sent a letter to Biden saying that he should pursue diplomatic channels. The letter said that he should also continue with military funding, but that diplomatic channels should be pursued. And this caused great controversy. They had to withdraw the letter, because the idea of diplomacy is so odious to the United States. Now, we know that the United States has never been interested in diplomacy. It's only interested in bombs. That's why, and war and violence. That's why there's another $400 million going to Ukraine now. But the idea of diplomacy should be pursued in the international community. The United States isn't going to do it. Some other country should, or the United Nations.
Gentlemen, pleasure always to check in with both of you. Professor Paul Sheldon Foote there joining us from Irvine, California, and Robert Fantina joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. It's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
In the US, a former Donald Trump aide, Kash Patel, has been questioned about claims documents found by the FBI at Mar-a-Lago had been declassified while Donald Trump was still president. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. CBS News has more on this story. An aide to former President Donald Trump acknowledged on Friday, 4th of November, that he appeared before a grand jury investigating White House documents recovered from Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Palm Beach, Florida. A spokesperson for Kash Patel, who served in the Trump White House in intelligence and defense roles and was designated by Donald Trump to be a representative to the National Archives and Records Administration, said in a statement to CBS News that Kash Patel testified to the Washington, D.C. grand jury on Thursday, 3rd of November. The spokesperson, Erica Knight, did not describe Patel's testimony, but said his testimony was compelled over his objection through the only legal means available to the government, a grant of limited immunity. The Justice Department in August seized White House files from Mar-a-Lago, some of which were labeled top secret. Donald Trump has insisted the documents were in his possession lawfully. Trump has also said that in the waning days of his presidency, he declassified some materials in his possession that had been classified. Kash Patel said in a May interview with Breitbart News that he was present as Trump declassified materials. Patel did not indicate on Friday if the grand jury asked him about that interview, in which he said Trump had declassified whole sets of materials in anticipation of leaving government. Donald Trump, who has not been charged in connection with his possession of the documents and maintains his innocence, sued the Justice Department in August, demanding a return of the seized documents. In October, an individual who worked at Mar-a-Lago told investigators that Trump directed the individual to move boxes of sensitive documents as the investigation was already underway, according to a person familiar with the matter. A special master appointed by the judge presiding over Trump's lawsuit is reviewing thousands of documents to determine which, if any, of the documents might be covered by attorney, client, or executive privilege. Trump's lawyers have said a president has broad declassification authority, but haven't echoed Donald Trump's claim that he declassified any of the seized materials. Federal prosecutors also say they're examining potential obstruction by Trump's legal team, alleging investigators were misled back in June when representatives from the former president said all classified documents had been returned to the government. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Kash Patel, a top advisor to Donald Trump, testified before a federal grand jury in Washington on Friday, 4th of November, about the former president's unauthorized retention of government documents at his Mar-a-Lago resort, according to a source familiar with the matter. The questioning from federal prosecutors centered on Kash Patel's claims the documents that the FBI found at the property had been declassified while Donald Trump was still president, as well as why the documents had been removed from the White House, the source said. Kash Patel testified before the grand jury after the Justice Department this week granted him limited immunity, which guaranteed he would not be prosecuted in the criminal investigation over his statements or information derived from them. The move to immunize Kash Patel reflects the importance of his testimony about the purported declassification and appears to reflect the decision to forego a potential case against him in order to secure evidence against a bigger target, such as Donald Trump himself. The status of the documents is important because if prosecutors can prove that those seized by the FBI during its search of Mar-a-Lago this summer were not declassified, it could strengthen a potential obstruction case contending that Trump used the claims as an excuse for why he did not return records that had been subpoenaed. Donald Trump and advisers like Kash Patel have claimed repeatedly since the Mar-a-Lago search that the seized documents were declassified, though no such evidence has emerged, and Trump's lawyers have not repeated the assertions in court filings, where they could face penalties for lying. The Associated Press tells us more about the same story. A close ally of former US President Donald Trump, who has said he was present as Trump declassified broad categories of materials, has appeared before a federal grand jury after being given immunity for his testimony, according to a person familiar with the matter. Kash Patel testified on Thursday after the Justice Department granted him immunity from prosecution and after a federal judge in Washington entered a sealed order to that effect. He had invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination during an earlier appearance before the grand jury. But the Justice Department, in an apparent acknowledgement of his importance as a witness, later granted him a limited form of immunity that protects him from having his testimony used against him. In a statement on Friday issued through a spokesperson, Kash Patel made clear that his appearance was not voluntary and denied that he had reached any sort of immunity deal with the Justice Department. Rather, his testimony was compelled over his objection through the only legal means available to the government, a grant of limited immunity, the statement said. It was not immediately clear on Friday what Patel had told the grand jury. The Justice Department is conducting a criminal investigation into the discovery of top-secret records seized in an FBI search of Donald Trump's Florida property at Mar-a-Lago on 8th of August. The FBI removed more than 100 documents with classification markings during that search. That's in addition to 15 boxes of records recovered back in January by the National Archives and Records Administration, as well as more than 36 documents with classification markings that were turned over to investigators in June. A former Justice Department prosecutor himself, Kash Patel is a close Donald Trump ally and held multiple roles in his administration, including as senior director for counterterrorism at the National Security Council, and later as chief of staff to the acting defense secretary, Chris Miller. In recent months, he has repeatedly and publicly lambasted the Justice Department's Mar-a-Lago investigation. In appearance this week on one conservative podcast, he described himself as all in with the boss when asked if he accept the position of FBI director if Donald Trump became president in 2024. Patel is presumably of interest to investigators because of his claims, including in a May interview with Breitbart News, that he was present as Donald Trump declassified material even though no changes had been made to classification markings on the documents.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Everything has been carefully planned for the annual New Year's greetings ceremony to the king. Government officials are all standing in line to perform the tradition of kissing the king's hand. But it seems someone special is absent from the ceremony. Iran is shocked and stunned with the news of a suicide. The suicide of well-known Qajar commander, Colonel Fazlullah. No one knows how the prime minister was notified of what had happened, but everyone saw his hasty exit from the New Year's greeting ceremony. A journey among historical documents.
Part 1.
The first person who arrives at the scene is then Prime Minister Vosukhodole. His presence at the colonel's house is not that strange. What's strange, though, is that he personally inspects the scene and does not issue the burial permit until the discovery of the colonel's letter before he committed suicide. It's now 9 days since the beginning of the new year, but the colonel's suicide has still not been reported to the public. Finally, after 10 days, Vosukh allows the coverage of the event, but only Ra'ad newspaper is allowed to publish it, without mentioning a motive for the suicide. You have to look for the answer to the riddle in the note that the colonel had written before killing himself. What is the motive of the suicide? Why does Vosukh prevent the publication of the news? The answer to these questions invites us to an exciting journey, a journey among historical records and documents. The sky is blue everywhere in the world. People are living in a dreadful sense of calm. A sense of calm which seems different. The calm before the storm. Musical instruments are not turned for love songs anymore. And martial music is a sign that something big is about to happen. The First World War is underway, a war that splits up the world into three separate parts. The Allied powers, the Central powers, and neutral countries. The flames of this partition reach the Middle East very soon. It had only been a few days since this Qajar king, who was only 18 years old, was formally crowned when Iran became the cradle of the greed of the warring sides. Despite that, the young Ahmad Shah's decision was announced by his prime minister.
Unfortunately, the royal decree did not work. Declaring neutrality was a false hope and was not even worth the paper it was written on. The British, intoxicated by the scent of Iran's oil, entered the country from the south and occupied Bushehr and Abadan. The roaring sound of the cannons prevents the voice of objection by the Iranian diplomats from being heard. The Den of the Lions formally turns into a battleground for the foxes and becomes a location for the warring sides to test their strength and force. After the Russians attack the north of the country, the Ottomans use this as an excuse to drag the war to this part of our neutral country and Azerbaijan, Kurdistan, Gilan, Hamedan, and Kermanshah traded hands between the Russians and Ottomans on several occasions. There is new word from the Northern Front in Iran, news of the victory of the October Revolution in Russia. Russia and a number of other countries formed the Soviet Union, and as a first step, they abandoned the war and recalled their forces from Iran. But instead of the Russian pullout serving as a victory for Iran, it serves the interests of the British. And when the Americans join the Allied forces in Europe, the British have no rivals left and dispatch more forces to Iran. The outcome is obvious. Iran is basically occupied by the British. Strange things are heard from different corners of Iran. The price of bread, like the price of foreign currency, is determined by the moment, and the price of wheat and barley has risen 100%. The British have occupied Iran's customs and imposed food and medicine sanctions on the country. They will not allow the distribution of the goods. Most of the imported goods go bad in the storage houses of the customs office or are ravaged by mice. Some of the goods are even returned to the countries that exported them. Poverty and famine are widespread across the country. Officers who are deployed to maintain order in the queues for bread get into skirmishes with the people. The population is suffering from water shortage, and the situation of medicine is even worse. Even in the capital, Tehran, many pharmaceutical products are not available to the people. The World War has ended after 4 years, and the era of reconstruction has begun. Still, the wheels of Iran's economy, a country plagued by famine, will not spin. The power structure does not have the force needed to run the country. And the average survival period of governments does not reach even 100 days. Everything has become entangled, and it seems there is no end to the pain and misery. Even dreaming about the return of tranquility to Iran is difficult. Only a promising spring can save this country, which seems to be suffering from an endless autumn, a spring which everyone is waiting for. Little by little, whispers are heard about the plans the young king has in mind, and it becomes a glimmer of hope in the hearts of the people. Something like a dream. It seems as the dream of tranquility is coming true. In the end, a powerful government is formed by this man, Mirza Hasan Khan Vosukhotdole. He's a lawyer. Aside from his academic studies, he's also educated in religious studies. He's a well-known political figure who has good relations with the British as well. Mirza Hasan takes over the empty treasury of Iran, a country ravaged by famine. The government doesn't have the ability to gather taxes and even has difficulty providing for its own expenses. The country's military force has practically no efficiency. Safety is non-existent all over the country. Even the streets of Tehran are unsafe. For a post-war and post-famine Iran, he has decided to expand the powers of the government and reform administrations, but this is not possible with an empty treasury. And Iran's neighboring countries are either colonies or staging revolutions or partitioning. But Vosukh sees another option on the table. This place is called Pasqal'e, a village with a pleasant climate, 2 kilometers away from Shemiran, the northernmost part of Tehran. It's a place with hot summers, with streaming rivers and tall trees, which provide you with a cool shade. This place will transform Iran's political history. Vosukh's decision to get out of the current situation is to establish relations with the West. Of course, among Western countries, England is more interesting to him, a country at the height of its power, the winner of the war, with many interests in Iran. Secret talks begin here, behind closed doors and far from the prying eyes of the media. The British side is represented by this man. Sir Percy Cox, a colonel and an experienced diplomat who's recently been appointed the British ambassador to Tehran. On the other side, these two men represent Iran's negotiating team, and the leader of the team is none other than Vosukhotdole. The British bring their package of proposals, which they had prepared in advance, to the negotiating table. The Iranian side bargains, and this causes the negotiations to take long and drag into late summer. But finally, the draft of the joint statement is ready. On Saturday morning, newspapers print news of the agreement between Iran and England. Known as the Anglo-Persian Agreement of 1919, the treaty includes 6 short articles. The first article reiterates its support for the independence and territorial integrity of Iran. England emphasizes that it adheres to the absolute respect of Iran as it has in the past. The second article hints at some sort of technical cooperation, interaction with the British to meet Iran's needs in expert fields,
turning Iran into some sort of employment agency which forces us to employ and pay British advisors. What can be gathered from the third article is the determination to support Iran's military forces. In truth, the British government gives us permission to have a united army and buy supplies from the British. And in the fourth article, with respect to Iran's depleted treasury, England commits itself to give Iran a loan that provides for the purchase of British weapons and the ability to pay the wages of British personnel in Iran. The fifth article of this agreement focuses on the development of Iran's railroad system. England considers itself responsible in encouraging us to improve our public transportation system. And in the last article of this agreement, England guarantees to cooperate with Iran's customs office, a customs which is managed by the British and is under their direct control. Immediately after the publication of the agreement, criticism of the deal is formed in different parts of the country. Opponents criticize the text of the agreement and express their concerns as to why the agreement was signed in secret. The criticism is directed at an agreement that Vosoul considers to be the only way out of the current situation for the country. Just 3 days after the agreement is signed, Ahmad Shah leaves Iran for Europe. Under such circumstances, with the absence of the king and the support of the British, Vosoul Qutdoule becomes the most powerful man in the country. The elites in society voice their criticism, and the possibility of the protests spreading among the people exists. At this point, at the request of Vosoul to calm the situation, Cox offers this note for the media to publish. He dismisses the concerns and calls critics ignorant. He insists the essence of the agreement is the preservation of Iran's independence. After the publication of Cox's letter, Vosoul offers his statement to the media. He makes a distinction between the opponents of the agreement and the people, thereby declaring martial law. Imposing martial law gives Vosoul the chance to suppress the opposition forces. Newspapers are shut down, widespread arrests are made, warnings are given to religious figures, and a number of opponents are exiled to Kashan. These actions bring back relative calm to the political atmosphere of the country. The calm has been achieved by shutting up critics, but is a fire smoldering under the ashes, a fire that flares up with the news of an event.
In the limelight.
Since Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's crown prince in 2017, the kingdom has detained hundreds of activists and human rights defenders, as well as bloggers, academics, and others for their political activism, showing nearly zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation of the crackdown on these people. Muslim scholars, particularly Shiite clerics and human rights activists from the Shia communities, have been executed, and women rights campaigners have been imprisoned and tortured, as freedom of expression, relationship between groups and their beliefs continue to be denied by the Saudi authorities. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The English website of Fast News Agency reports, an international human rights organization warned against the appalling conditions of human rights in Saudi Arabia and the brutal forms of physical and mental torture that state authorities use against imprisoned political dissidents and pro-democracy campaigners. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights said in a report that Saudi citizens are subject to all kinds of torture ever since they're arrested under trumped-up charges, and the torments do not stop even after rulings are passed and include the families and relatives of the detainees as well. The group added that Saudi officials carry out various types of mental and physical torture against the detainees who later face the death penalty. They are severely beaten and forcibly disappeared for long periods of time during detention. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights went on to note that Saudi authorities make use of different methods of physical torture, including electric shocks, sleep deprivation, beatings, extraction of nails from fingers, and hanging from the feet to force the imprisoned activists into signing confessions. The human rights organization pointed to the case of Saudi teenager Mustafa al-Darwish, who was executed in June of 2021 and was forced to sign a confession under the threat of a retrial. Apart from physical torture, the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights has observed the use of psychological torture against a number of detainees, including threats to their families. Haider Al-Leif, a protester who was executed on 23rd of April 2019, was threatened that if he did not sign the confession, his wife would be summoned to prison to divorce him. According to the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, detainees endure other brutal measures, such as deprivation of contact with their families and daily insults. In many cases, torture results in permanent disability, in injury, pain, coma, and loss of consciousness. The Saudi prisoners are denied the right to medical treatment. The report added that Munir al-Adam, a young man who was executed along with 36 other men on 23rd of April 2019, lost his hearing because of torture, and Abdullah al-Tarif, another young man who was executed in the same mass execution, was also tortured. Torture caused damage to Abdullah al-Tarif's spinal vertebrae, as well as deviation of his left eye, and other parts of his body were also harmed. Agence France-Presse explains more about the same story. A Saudi court of law has sentenced 10 Egyptian men for up to 18 years for trying to organize a remembrance event for the 1973 Arab-Israeli war between the Tel Aviv regime and a coalition of Arab states led by Egypt and Syria. Two relatives, speaking on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals, said that the court found the men from Nubian ethnic group guilty of establishing a terrorist group. The Egyptian men were first arrested in October of 2019 for trying to organize the event. They were released without charge in December of that year, but were rearrested the following July. The relatives of the men said, "I have intense anger at the extreme injustice to which our people have been subjected." The relative said one man received an 18-year sentence, one was jailed for 16 years, two were jailed for 14 years and the others for between 10 and 12 years. Human rights groups had previously campaigned for the men's release and denounced the proceedings against them as a travesty of justice. They said the men were being prosecuted for the peaceful exercise of their right to freedom of expression and trying to organize a community event. Activists said the men had been denied regular family contact and only allowed access to government-appointed lawyers, and that at least two of the men are elderly and in a state of poor health. The relative said three of the men are over 60 years old. Prominent human rights group, Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, in a Twitter post, denounced recent sentences as harsh. Democracy for the Arab World Now, a US-based advocacy organization, also said the rulings were unfair. The report comes amid Saudi Arabia's back-channel attempts to normalize diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. The website of Middle East Eye covers the same story, but from a different angle. A group of human rights advocates voiced concern that the British government may be complicit in human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia, citing lack of clarity over what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund supports in the kingdom. In a report published recently, some campaigners said that at a time when the